Only a Game is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR in Boston, I'm Karen Given, and this is NPR's Only a Game. Bill Littlefield is on vacation this week. The second round of the NFL playoffs is underway. Ahead on Only a Game, we'll hear how the pigskin communities of Denver and Houston are dealing with sudden postseason success. Also, meet the play-by-play legend who's taking his talent from the diamond to the bowling lanes. And was Michael Jordan really cut from his high school team? Also ahead, prominent mathematicians devise formulas that shake up the sports world.
Another possibility is to use phi, which is the CDF, the standard normal distribution. Perhaps that will give us the probabilities that A will beat B.
Stay tuned.
Major funding for Only a Game comes from Oliver Wyman, a global management consulting firm with 3,000 professionals worldwide. Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com.
This is Only a Game. I'm Karen Given, in for Bill Littlefield. The second round of the NFL playoffs will soon be underway with twin tussles today. The San Francisco 49ers will host the New Orleans Saints, and the New England Patriots will attempt to withstand the otherworldly charisma of the Denver Broncos and their second-year quarterback, Tim Tebow. Here to discuss Denver's chances against the highly favored Patriots is Dave Krieger of the Denver Post. Dave, welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks, Karen.
In a column this week, you asserted that the Broncos are, quote, playing with house money in today's game. How so?
Well, no one expects them to win, that's for sure. As you mentioned, the Patriots are favored by 2 touchdowns. No one expected the Broncos to win last week when they played their first playoff game against the Pittsburgh Steelers. And they have a quarterback that half the country doesn't seem to think can play the game. So you add all those things up, the Broncos have absolutely nothing to lose.
As you point out in your column, no team with an 8-8 regular season record has ever advanced past the divisional round. Is there anything about this Broncos team that makes you think they'll be the first?
Well, only their history of doing the unexpected. This team has won 4 times in overtime this year. No other team in NFL history has ever done that, with the exception of another team that John Fox, their head coach, coached back in Carolina. And so they have a flair for the dramatic. The first 3 quarters tend to be their weak point, and that's, you know, saying something, because that's 75% of the game. And so that's their object tonight, is just stay in the game until the end.
We have already mentioned that Tim Tebow seems to be a polarizing figure everywhere outside of Florida, maybe. How is he perceived in Denver?
I think he's beloved in Denver. Personally, he comes off really well. There's always some child who has suffered through surgeries or sickness or something that a child shouldn't have to go through, who is at every home game and who is greeted by Tim Tebow and Tim Tebow's family, and whose day is made, not to say week or year, by that interaction. He has a charm, a personal charm and a personal perspective that I think has really won people over. On the football side, there is a debate about his skill set and whether it matches what's required in the NFL. But the bottom line is winning games, and he's done that.
All right, Dave, I can't let you go without a prediction. Who wins tonight, the Broncos or the Patriots?
Well, I'm afraid, Karen, that my prediction record is exactly counter to the actual result. So I always pick against the Broncos because that seems to be the only way that they can win. So I'm picking the Patriots 30-20.
Dave Krieger is a sports columnist for the Denver Post. Dave, thanks for speaking with me.
My pleasure, Karen.
In tomorrow's NFC playoff matchup, Aaron Rodgers and the Green Bay Packers will host Eli Manning and the New York Giants. In the AFC game, the Baltimore Ravens will host the Houston Texans, who are coming off the first playoff victory in franchise history. Joining me now is Houston Chronicle sports columnist Jerome Solomon. Jerome, welcome to Only a Game.
Hello, Karen. Thank you.
The Houston Oilers skipped town in 1996 and landed in Tennessee, where they eventually became the Titans. The Texans played their inaugural season in 2002. What was the reaction in Houston after the victory over Cincinnati last weekend?
It was another rebirth, in a sense. The city was crushed when the Oilers left town. I mean, it was a team that was well-supported. Our favorite sons are Earl Campbell and Coach Bum Phillips, and they didn't leave out of a lack of support. They just left because the owner and the mayor in town couldn't come to an agreement on building a new stadium. So the city is rejoicing, I should say.
Well, this year, the Titans failed to make the playoffs, and so did that other team, you know, the one over in Dallas. Is all of that just, I don't know, butter on the Texas toast for Houston this season?
That's the toast. It's not the butter at all. So, yeah, there's a lot of circular joy for Texans fans being excited that they're doing well and the Cowboys are not.
Matt Schaub was Houston's starting quarterback when the season started. The Texans won last weekend, not with Schaub's replacement, but with the guy who replaced the guy who replaced the guy who replaced Schaub. Tell us about rookie T.J. Yates.
No one expected him to play. The coaches didn't even plan for him to play. You know, Schaub was injured. The next week, Matt Leinart was injured in the first half. So T.J. Yates runs onto the field, and he walks into the huddle, and several of the offensive players didn't even know that Matt Leinart had been injured on the previous play. And they looked up and said, "What the hell are you doing in the game?" They were as shocked as he was, but he has been calm, fairly cool, and he has played extremely well.
The Ravens' defense is a perennial powerhouse, and Baltimore beat Houston 29-14 in Week 6. How will the Texans' offense fare against Ray Lewis and company this time around?
The Texans' best offensive player, or certainly their most effective downfield threat, Andre Johnson, was injured and didn't play that game. He will be here. So they expect to move the ball. They know it won't be easy, but their defense is rated higher than the Ravens' defense. It's just a younger defense, and this is their first year doing it, so they don't get as much publicity for what they've done this season as the Ravens have.
In your blog this week, you wrote, "While the Ravens are thinking about the Super Bowl, the Texans are thinking about earning the first road playoff victory in franchise history." Why do you see that as an advantage for the Texans?
The Super Bowl is 3 games from now, and the Ravens have spent all of the last couple of weeks and most of this season talking about this is the year to go to the Super Bowl. Well, you have to win this week and next week before you get to the Super Bowl. The Texans, they're not even talking about a Super Bowl. They're so focused on this game that I think they do get a slight advantage in that sense. Whether it plays out and means anything come game time, it probably won't. But after the game, we'll say that it did.
Jerome Solomon is a sports columnist for the Houston Chronicle. Jerome, thanks for speaking with me.
No problem. Thank you.
Every NBA team was traumatized by the most recent lockout, but few teams have dealt with the uncertainty that the New Orleans Hornets have recently endured. After a few years of mismanagement and declining attendance, it was rumored that New Orleans was one of the teams the NBA considered eliminating. But fans have begun to swarm to the Hornets' hive, and the team expects it will be in the Big Easy for a while. From New Orleans, Keith O'Brien has the story.
On a recent Wednesday night, the Hornets took the floor in the New Orleans arena to square off against the Philadelphia 76ers. The 76ers and Hornets collectively have no marquee stars and little chance of competing for an NBA title this season. But near the top of Section 117, fans were chanting, and one of them, Charisse Otis, was wearing a Hornets-themed costume. That's how much she cares.
It's mostly all Hornets colors, purple, gold, and blue. I have on a tutu that I made that's mostly gold, but it has blue and purple accents, a purple Hornets shirt, purple wig. I love big eyelashes, so I have on big blue eyelashes, blue contacts, and some purple tights and some blue boots.
Such enthusiasm is somewhat surprising. The NBA assumed ownership of the Hornets a little over a year ago after a failed attempt to find a buyer. The team's best player, star point guard Chris Paul, was traded just days before the season began for three less well-regarded players and a draft pick. And by the end of last season, the Hornets had less than 6,000 season ticket holders. To be viable, they needed to sell an additional 4,000 season tickets amidst an NBA lockout, widespread fan dissatisfaction, and general economic woes. That's when the Hornets got creative and produced this.
If there's one thing we've proved in New Orleans, it's that we never take a challenge lightly.
Every person, every business,
and every family
who is here now has made a choice.
The voices in the Hornets commercial were familiar. New Orleans Saints quarterback Drew Brees, Louisiana's U.S. senators, the mayor, the governor, famous musicians, and even the local archbishop all appeared in the new ad campaign, telling fans where they stood on the Hornets.
I'm in.
I'm in.
I'm in.
I'm in.
Oh, you know I'm in.
I'm in. Are you?
It turned out to be exactly the right thing to say, recalls team president Hugh Weber.
So that while everyone else was talking about lockouts and bickering and fighting of owners and the potential of contraction because of NBA ownership and all this other stuff, we were talking about New Orleans, right? We didn't have players to use. We didn't have X's and O's to talk about. What we could talk about is how we fit into the fabric of the new New Orleans.
With the players locked out, front office executives essentially went door to door, often meeting groups of fans in their own living rooms. Fans like Daryl Romero, one of thousands who signed up for season tickets in recent months.
I'm in it with, you know, with the mayor and with the governor and all these other beautiful fans here. You know, we're all in it together as a team.
And finally, last month, just before the season began and the front office shipped Chris Paul to the Los Angeles Clippers, the Hornets met their goal of 10,000 season ticket holders, an achievement that didn't surprise head coach Monty Williams, who was one of those team officials going door to door.
It was the one chance I had to get to know the people in our community. And whether it was in the Ninth Ward or New Orleans East or Metairie or somewhere else downtown, it was a great time to get to know our fan base. And now I see those people at the games. It's pretty cool.
The fans early on this season, though, aren't getting to see a lot of winning. In that Wednesday night game against the 76ers, the Hornets managed to blow an early 14-point lead, getting routed down the stretch 101-93 as the fans in the arena groaned.
Come on, man!
The players admit it's going to take time to learn how to work together, or even just to master the playbook, says Chris Kaman, a 7-foot center who was acquired in the Paul trade and is one of 10 new players on the Hornets' hastily assembled roster.
We got traded here after the first preseason game was already done. There was only one left. Trying to get all the plays down, the defensive coverages, and then gel with the guys, kind of get on their same page with everybody. And it's just kind of it's a difficult situation.
The team is still looking for a long-term stadium lease and a buyer. But Weber thinks they'll get that lease and a new owner in the months ahead. He's confident, he says, that the team will be staying. And for the moment anyway, that alone is reason enough to cheer. For Only a Game, I'm Keith O'Brien in New Orleans.
Not in our house! Not in our house!
It's 19 minutes past the hour. John 3:16. It's the only Bible verse I remember from Sunday school. For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son. Believe me, I can recite the whole thing. So can Tim Tebow. He famously displayed the book chapter and verse on his eye black when he led the Florida Gators to win the 2009 BCS title. Exactly 3 years later, Tebow threw for exactly 316 yards in last Sunday's AFC wildcard win over the Steelers. Pretty cool, eh? He also set a new NFL playoff record with 31.6 yards per completion. I bet you can guess where the game's TV rating peaked out on CBS. Also 31.6. I'm Karen Given, filling in for Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, an annual cross-country skiing event brings artificial snowflakes and big bucks to a down-on-its-luck main mill town. But first, perhaps you've heard this one before. Michael Jordan, the greatest basketball player who ever lived, was cut by his high school coach. Except he wasn't. He was put on the JV team as a sophomore, where he thrived. Thomas Lake writes about what he calls, quote, the most famous roster decision in high school basketball history, end quote, for this week's Sports Illustrated. And he joins me from Georgia Public Broadcasting in Atlanta. Thomas, welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, let's start here. Michael Jordan was not cut from his Laney High team in Wilmington, North Carolina. Or was he?
I guess it's a matter of semantics. He says he was cut. Many other people have repeated the story over the years. But the fact is, he was in 10th grade at the time. There were combined tryouts for the varsity and the junior varsity team. It was extremely rare for a 10th grader to make varsity. And ultimately, Jordan made the JV team, just like most other 10th graders, with one exception, his friend Leroy Smith, a name that Jordan would then mention again and again over the next few decades as a person who inspired him to get better and better, because he could never forget that Leroy Smith had made varsity when he didn't.
Leroy Smith is, of course, another big part of the myth. He did make the high school varsity team as a sophomore. Here's Eddie Murphy's brother, Charlie, portraying Smith in a viral marketing campaign for Nike.
After I beat out MJ for the last spot on our varsity team, he went on to become the greatest basketball player of all time. Coincidence? No way!
So the fictional Leroy Smith also calls himself the world's most influential influence on Michael Jordan ever. Was he?
You know, that's not that far off. I mean, it was clear that Jordan was incredibly motivated by this incident, that he came back with this sort of incredible fury at those JV games. He would score 40 and 50 points. He learned how to become a superstar that year, and when he came back the next year in his junior year and did play on varsity for the same coach, there was no stopping him.
It all worked out fine for Jordan, as we all know. He's a six-time NBA champion, two-time Olympic gold medal winner, and a member of the NBA Hall of Fame. Things didn't turn out quite so well for the coach who cut him, Pop Herring. Where is he today?
Coach Herring lives in Wilmington, North Carolina. It has been almost 30 years since he coached basketball. He's mentally ill. He walks around the streets. He can be seen most often in a neighborhood called Brooklyn. And he's subsisting on government checks.
And he wasn't terribly easy to find, was he?
No. For years, he had been living with various relatives who provided sort of a shield around him. But then most of them died. And now he's living with an adopted brother and some other people. He and some friends spend most days under a big oak tree sitting at a picnic table, drinking and smoking.
Pop Herring's most successful season came 2 years after Michael Jordan's tenure as the star of his varsity squad ended. But soon after that, the then 31-year-old ran into trouble. What happened?
Apparently, he had a long family history of mental illness. And in his early 30s, it came upon him. He began acting paranoid. He thought people were going through his stuff. People were out to get him. The school administrators told him, hey, you should take some time off. You should get some psychiatric help. He thought this was further evidence of persecution. It got worse and worse. And finally, the school let him go. And he was never able to coach again. He eventually lost his wife and daughter. They moved away because he wouldn't get help like they wanted him to, and he quickly became alone.
Pop's mother and sister had already died in 1994 when Jordan retired for the first time, and the Bulls brought Herring to the United Center for a tribute to their star. This was how Pop was introduced to the crowd of 20,000 and the 2 million viewers on TNT.
Ladies and gentlemen, from Laney High School in Wilmington, North Carolina, Coach Clifton Herring and Coach Ron Coley. Please stand up and acknowledge the fact that you cut this man in high school.
Yeah.
This sort of thing didn't cause Pop's mental illness, of course, but it certainly couldn't have helped.
No, of course not. I mean, here's a guy who's already predisposed to thinking that people are out to get him, and then to have something like this happen from a player who's meant so much to you. Pop wasn't smiling or laughing, you know. To him, it was a serious thing, and he didn't appreciate being portrayed that way.
Your article speaks to the 31 years of goodwill Pop built up before calling in favors during the last 28 years of his mental decline. Do you get the sense that Pop feels like his most famous and wealthy player has done enough to answer that call?
He really talked around that, and that happens a lot. He kind of talks in circles, so I could never be certain how he feels about Jordan now. In general, he does seem to believe that people who were his closest friends before he got sick could have done more to help him afterwards. On the other hand, because Pop knows he has a tendency to blow all his cash as soon as he gets it, this guy Leroy Grady has a great system where he takes Pop's checks and then goes and sees him every other day and hands him the cash. And that way, it lasts throughout the month, whereas otherwise it would just be gone in a couple of days.
Why was it so important to Michael Jordan to encourage the myth that he had been slighted?
I guess you'd have to ask him that. But if I had to guess, I mean, I don't know. I would say that it's sort of an inspiring story, isn't it? I mean, we've all had a moment like that in our lives where people didn't think we were good enough and we had to prove them wrong.
Thomas Lake is a senior writer for Sports Illustrated. His article, Did This Man Really Cut Michael Jordan?, appears in the January 16th issue. You can also find it on our website, onlyagame.org. Thomas, thanks for joining me.
Thanks so much for having me, Karen.
Each January, the fastest American cross-country skiers converge on the best trails in the country, places like Anchorage, Alaska, Park City, Utah, and this year, Rumford, Maine, at whose heart is a paper mill that employs a small fraction of the workers it once did. But citizens of Rumford pride themselves on their ability to create something from nothing. The latest example of that is landing one of the nation's biggest cross-country ski races. New Hampshire Public Radio's Sam Evans-Brown has the story.
And ladies and gentlemen, we are underway!
For any American cross-country skier looking to compete internationally, all roads lead through the Nationals. Take Torin Kuss, for example, a former member of the U.S. World Cup team who's battling here to regain his lost spot.
Hopefully, you know, I think there's a chance if I am the overall sprint leader after this that I should be able to get some start spots in the Spring World Cups. So that's a little bit of a carrot.
These racers are dedicated to their sport, and they will go wherever they have to go to compete in the national championships, even to Rumford, Maine, a once thriving paper mill town that the economy has left in tatters. Peter Kling, who skis for Alaska Pacific University, says that the skiers understand what these races mean for the people in town.
But it's definitely a pretty tough town. People have that in the back of their minds. They're like, oh, I don't really want to go and race there, but they're going to do the best they can, and it's going to be racing, and so we're really happy that they're able to do what they can do.
The racers converge once a year for a week of racing. The bidding for which venue gets to host the races is aggressive. Black Mountain, Rumford's community ski area, has hosted these races for 2 years in a row. To understand how the races ended up in a hard-scrabble town like Rumford, one has to understand the people of Rumford. A surprising number of them pitch in to help the host, the Chisholm Ski Club, to make the races possible. Jeff Knight is out grooming the trails at 2 in the morning before the first race.
I've got to get the course ready for the races. There are a few places that were a little thin, so I'm covering those over with digging out snow and covering them over like I'm doing right now. I just groom it all up. It's ready for the kids, and they get here at 9 o'clock.
Knight's efforts to prep the course are just the start of the work. Terry Richard coordinates the army of Chisholm Ski Club volunteers who roll in at the crack of dawn on race days.
We have well over 100 volunteers that are here for the day, and we start at 6:30 in the morning.
And of all those people who are doing this work,
How many of them actually are paid?
Zero.
Those volunteers do get a free meal shared among friends at a spot called Muriel's Kitchen. The kitchen's namesake, Muriel Arsenault, had to retire a few years back, and it's now run by her daughter-in-law, Sally, who doesn't even cross-country ski, but she can't stay away from these races.
It's the love for the sport. It really is the love of the sport. This town used to be so huge on skiing, and we're hoping that we're able to keep everybody's interest and keep them coming back. It's just an amazing place.
All of this effort and organization spins around one family name, the Broomhalls.
Name is Ray Broomhall, and I've been a member of the Chisholm Ski Club for 99 years.
Ray Broomhall finally retired from Chisholm last year at age 77.
Over my years, it's been quite an experience, you know, watching the kids come up and coaching the kids from the junior program right up through to the high school program. And if it wasn't for Chummy, I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing.
Chummy is Ray's older brother, who at 92 years old still makes it out to every ski race. Chummy has a lifetime of ski stories to tell.
In 1950, I was on the U.S. team, and it was supposed to be in Lake Placid, and they didn't have any snow, and I hadn't joined the team yet.
He served in the 10th Mountain Division in World War II and skied in the Olympics in 1948 and 1952. People in Rumford call him the patron saint of skiing, and there's a kind of reverence in their voice when they talk about him. Chummy has poured his life into the Chisholm Ski Club and was instrumental in bringing the Nationals to town. So if not for the aging members of the club, the town of Rumford would be hurting worse than it is. The races put bodies in hotel beds, account for grocery and gas purchases, and fill a week's worth of restaurant tables. A study of the races estimates that they bring about $1.5 million worth of direct and indirect economic impact. Jean DeSalle owns a motel in Rumford.
It makes a very big impact on the community. I think we'd be dead if it wasn't for these races. I've talked to other businesses that are up in Bethel, and if they don't have ski teams staying here right now, they have nothing because there's no snow.
For the second year in a row, Mother Nature failed to deliver natural snow in time for the races. To save last year's races, volunteers trucked in snow from further north and dumped it on the course. This year, Black Mountain brought in modern snow guns and poured $100,000 and 600 man-hours into covering the trails with artificial snow. This expense is possible because of the Maine Winter Sports Center, a not-for-profit that secured about $6 million in grant money to buy Black Mountain and renovate it so it could host top races.
Unofficially, Libus, Johnson, Norris, Gelso, Cook, and Zimmerman. That's the way we have it at the moment.
Last week's races went off without a hitch, despite the uncooperative weather. The story of the week was 20-year-old Jessie Diggins, who won 3 out of the 4 women's races. But even with the thrill of victory hanging in the air, there's concern about the future of skiing in Rumford, and at Chisholm in particular. Ray Broomhall is worried.
With the age group out here, you don't know how long it's going to last because they're so old, you know. Like I say, and I hate to say it, but I think once Chummy's gone, they're going to see a lot of them drop out because they're just more or less doing it for him.
Ray guesses that the average age of the Chisholm volunteers is at least 72. School enrollment in Rumford is dropping, and the median age is rising as every year more young people move away. New blood isn't filling the ranks of the Chisholm Ski Club, but the races and skiing in general are a bright spot for a town that might otherwise feel left behind by history. For Only a Game, I'm Sam Evans Brown.
Pink, tourmaline, and blue, all bite. That's the color of the Rumford sky tonight. And the clouds above Black Mountain are moving faster than the cars by the chicken coop. The Boise Cascade Air Pollution Control Tower looks like a giant cocktail toothpick in the night with the little red squiggle at the top. Blinking on and off.
You're listening to Only a Game. If you're a sports fan, chances are you've listened to or watched Gary Thorne more than once. His broadcasting resume includes coverage of the NHL, Olympics, college football, and basketball. And he's best known for his more than two decades of Major League Baseball play-by-play. Thorne has called a lot of balls and strikes, but soon he'll be calling strikes and spares for the Professional Bowlers Association on ESPN. And he joins me now. Gary, let me start off by asking, are you a bowler?
Actually, I am a bowler. I grew up in a small town in Maine, and we actually had a couple of bowling alleys, and that was where you went on Friday night to gather with friends.
You're stepping in for Rob Stone, who's leaving ESPN to cover soccer for Fox Sports. Have you ever done bowling coverage before?
Yeah, I actually did. When I was in Maine, I was actually practicing law at the time and doing broadcasting on the side. Maine Public Television actually carried a series of 10-pin bowling, and it ran for like the entire winter season once a week, and it was great fun. I loved it.
Well, is it fair to say in terms of style that bowling broadcasts require a little more golf whisper than home run call?
Yeah, I'm going to find out where they got the plexiglass. See if there's any separation between the lanes and myself. I'll have to be very careful about that because obviously it's a little different than doing a hockey game. I don't think the bowlers would appreciate the kind of exuberance you get in a hockey broadcast and a play-by-play of bowling. So, yeah, I think there's going to be a little bit of the whisper man involved in that one.
Bowling recently lost one of its icons. Don Carter died last week at the age of 85. The PBA called him its original superstar. What are your memories of Carter?
Well, Don Carter was the face of bowling. I mean, he put it on the map in the 50s. He was as much of a superstar in sports, all of sports, as anybody else. He was the first athlete in any sport to have a million-dollar contract with a company. It was a bowling ball company outside of the work that he was doing. I mean, that's pretty amazing that it would be a bowler who would have that kind of a contract deal before anybody in football, basketball, or baseball would get it, but he did. He created the concept of the tour. He wanted it to be like golf. And, of course, he was a great bowler. He was a great athlete, for that matter. And he really did put a face to the game of bowling.
Sportscaster Gary Thorne will be calling the three major tournaments left in the PBA's season, beginning with the U.S. Bowling Congress Masters in Las Vegas later this month. This spring, he'll return to moonlighting as the TV voice of the Baltimore Orioles. Gary, thanks a lot.
Okay, I'll go with a whisper. Thanks, Karen.
Richard shot, save, rebound, score! Ruslan Fedotenko!
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Nuance, offering Dragon 11 speech recognition software for creating documents and emails and surfing the web all by speaking at nuance.com. And Oliver Wyman, a global management consulting firm with 3,000 professionals serving global 1,000 companies, oliverwyman.com. This is NPR.
When Reiner Hertrick strapped on his skis on November 1st, 2003, he didn't know it was the beginning of a streak that would last 2,993 days. That's 8 years, 2 months, and 10 days. The German-born ski slope groomer has followed the snow from Colorado to Oregon to South America. He's kept skiing through a separated shoulder, bruised ribs, and minus 50-degree wind chills. It was a trip to intensive care on Tuesday that finally brought an end to the run. I always said it would be a hospital bed that would stop this streak, Hertrick told ESPN. His condition has since stabilized, but it's unclear when he'll next strap on a pair of skis. I'm Karen Given, filling in for the vacationing Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, sports makes math more fun, but does math take all the fun out of sports? But first, Charlie Pierce is here with the week's news. Hi, Charlie.
Hey, Karen.
Let's start with the NFL game that everyone's talking about. Who do you pick, New Orleans or San Francisco?
I think the Saints capital S will keep rolling because I know we're going to talk about the Saint lowercase s in a moment.
Well, all the talk has been about Denver v. New England. Get this, the 13-3 Patriots haven't beaten a team that ended up with a winning record all season. The Broncos went 8-8, but with last week's unlikely win over Pittsburgh, they're technically 9-8, so it's all Broncos all the way, right?
No, because New England went to Denver and kicked them all over the field earlier this season, and now they've got Denver at home in a game that they really need to shut people up. And if you give the Patriots any reason to want to shut people up, they will do it. I suspect this game will end up pretty much the same way they won it Denver did.
Tomorrow, Baltimore hosts Houston, and the New York Giants are in Green Bay. Which teams advance?
I think Baltimore advances easily. I think Houston has got its playoff win. It's a nice season, but Baltimore is rested up. They're healthy. They're still one of, if not the best defensive team in the league. I think they handle Houston easily, and I think the Giants are going to beat the Packers. I think the Giants are playing right at the top of their form, especially defensively now, and if I had to pick an upset, that would be it.
College football experts were almost unanimous that LSU would win the BCS championship. So, of course, Alabama came out on top on Monday. Alabama was dominant, albeit not very exciting, in the 21-0 win. Did you manage to stay awake for the late touchdown in the fourth quarter?
Well, I was running around New Hampshire following Republicans, so anything else was a relief. I thought, you know, the Alabama defense keeping Louisiana State bottled up on its own side of the field for most of the game was really kind of a remarkable performance. Once again, I was struck by the fact that you had two of the best college football teams I've ever seen, and neither one of them had a quarterback. And Jordan Jefferson of LSU picked exactly the wrong time to have the worst game he's ever had.
At least one source says a deal is done to create some sort of playoff for next year's BCS championship. But BCS officials are considering 50 to 60 different proposals. Do you expect changes?
How can you possibly have 60 different proposals on how to run a football playoff? What's the 59th? Bobbing for apples? I mean, there's only so many ways you can do this.
I have a surprise for you, Charlie.
What's that?
Heisman winner RG3, that's Robert Griffin III, is leaving Baylor to go pro.
No!
I know!
Really? He might want to play in the NFL rather than do another year in Waco? It's hard for me to believe that. Good for him. He was the most exciting college football player of the year. I'm glad he won the Heisman. He's got no reason to stay. I hope he succeeds at the next level because he really is a terrific player.
On Wednesday, the NCAA approved the Cecil Newton Rule. It's a new bylaw that says any parent shopping an athletic child to a school is, in fact, an agent. Cecil Newton asked Mississippi State for a $180,000 payment in exchange for the services of Cam Newton. The new measure will close that particular loophole, but does it mean that new ones will open up?
First of all, the loophole is not closed. There's always an uncle or an aunt you can use as a bag man. Second of all, this is just another way for the NCAA to make sure that nobody but them gets any money. I'm sure some poor dad who's worked, you know, 19 miserable jobs his entire life and has a kid who can throw the ball 90 yards will get caught and be made an example of. Frankly, whatever the NCAA does to tighten up its eligibility rules makes my skin itch. So I hope the Cecil Newton Rule, you know, is shredded with loopholes within a year.
The NBA season is just 3 weeks old. Are there any surprises yet?
Well, the biggest surprise to me is that the Los Angeles Clippers are actually living up to their, wait for it, clippings. They got the Miami Heat at home and beat them, and they're being thrown across television on all the different platforms by the NBA. This is a good thing for the Clippers, and whose fans richly deserve a little bit of positive attention.
Well, it's a good thing for the Clippers, but what about us? Who are we going to make fun of all season long?
Well, we'll find someone, I'm sure.
According to HockeyFights.com, fighting majors and games with at least one fight in the NHL are down compared to last year. Do you think this is a good thing or a bad thing for the
sport? Question is, what does HockeyFights.com think of it? Because if they drop the fighting, what good is having the domain name HockeyFights.com? It is a good thing, and I hope it has something to do with the attention being given to chronic brain trauma in both the NFL and the NHL. And I've never been a big hockey fight fan anyway, and if it were to disappear entirely tomorrow, I wouldn't have any regrets at all.
Baseball Commissioner Bud Selig had maintained since 2008 that 2012 would be his last season at the head of the sport. How's that working out for him?
He's got his contract extended through 2014. We makes him the second longest tenured commissioner behind Kennesaw Mountain Landis. Bud Selig will be 80 years old when this deal ends. Why they decided to extend him and not look for a younger commissioner, I have no idea. The only thing I can think of is that his primary employers, namely the owners, like what he's doing.
Major League Baseball and the Dodgers have come to an agreement with Fox Sports. The team's existing media rights deal will be honored. But will anyone want to buy the bankrupt Dodgers without assurances of a better media deal in the future?
Well, this is, I mean, if you want to see the downside of Bud Selig's tenure, this is part of it, because it was he who kept meddling in the attempts to, quote unquote, rescue the Dodgers from the mess that was the McCourt divorce. And this is just a spinoff of that. I don't know who would be willing to invest in the Dodgers if your broadcast rights aren't clear.
Manny Ramirez, who retired from baseball rather than serve a doping suspension, wants back in. He's made a rather heartfelt pledge, don't you think?
Yeah, he wants to show that Manny can change, and he wants to show his kids that if you make a mistake, don't quit. Go back and fix it. I don't think there's any chance in the world that anyone will hire him.
Clearly, the Maryland legislature has solved all of that state's problems, because during the session, which started this week, they intend to consider whether fantasy football should be exempt from gambling laws. Wait, that can't be right.
Wait a minute. Federal law exempts fantasy football from gambling? I did not know this. What a scam!
Learn something new every day, right?
What an unbelievable scam. Look, do you put money down in fantasy football?
Yes.
Can you lose it?
Yes.
It's gambling. That's all I need to know.
And finally, Charlie, the Williams Formula One team has a plan to speed up drivers' pit stops. Care to explain?
Yeah, they're going to hire Michael Johnson, the legendary track star, to try to put a training program for the pit crew and then evaluate them in terms of, I guess, economy of motion and stuff like this. It sounds like a really good thing, except you might have to run 400 yards in a circle to change a tire.
Charlie Pierce writes the politics blog for Esquire magazine, and he joins Bill Littlefield each week at this time on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thank you, Karen.
The one thing I can tell you, the one thing you gotta do, you gotta move, you gotta move, and you gotta move. All right.
You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing to us care of WBUR FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215, or by emailing oag@wbur.bu.edu. Please let us know on which station you hear Only a Game and how to pronounce your name. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860 or visit our website, onlyagame.org.
You guys, let's listen up. We won a game yesterday, and if we win one today, that's two in a row. We win one tomorrow, that's called a winning streak.
Hollywood loves winning streaks and losing streaks and hitting streaks, putting streaks, and three-point shooting streaks. There's always a good plot line behind them. In 1989's Major League, the hapless Cleveland Indians go on a winning streak to spite the owner, who wants to move the team to a warmer climate. ESPN and your local newspaper like streaks too. But here's something I learned last week at the 2012 Joint Mathematics Meetings in Boston. Mathematicians don't like streaks.
There's a narrative you have to create that says so-and-so clearly did this well because he's hot right now, because his wife just gave birth to a kid, so he's on fire.
Fact is, says Chris Jones, professor of mathematics at St. Mary's College of California, the narrative we assign to a streak is often just our brain trying to explain something that happens quite naturally.
You can have a computer be streaky, right? You can toss a coin 10 times and get 6 heads in a row. It doesn't mean the coin was on fire or hot or whatever phrase you would use if it was a sports person. It just means that happens sometimes, even if it's a 50-50 coin.
And that's not the only narrative mathematicians say the sports world gets wrong. Certainly you've heard that the only fair way to choose an NCAA football champion would be to hold a playoff, right? You might have heard it on this very program from Dan Wetzel of Yahoo Sports.
They have to do something. Look, we're one result away from the entire month of December not mattering at all. If they can bake it into a four-team playoff, at the very least, then it would be a massive step forward for the sport.
When the commissioners of the 11 Football Bowl Series conferences met on Tuesday, they considered 50 or 60 different proposals for change, reportedly including a 4-team playoff, 8-team playoff, and 16-team playoff. But the changes that need to be made to the BCS system have nothing to do with a playoff, at least not according to Mike Weimerskirch of Augsburg College in Minnesota.
Another possibility is to use the fee, which is the CDF of the standard normal distribution. Perhaps that will give us the probabilities that A will beat B.
Okay, I have no idea what change Professor Weimerskirch is suggesting. I haven't taken a math class since the ever-patient Mr. Lockwood got me through AP Calculus during my senior year at 29 Palms High School. But one thing is clear. Weimerskirch believes a playoff would be mathematically less fair than the current system.
The mantra of the statistician is data is good. If you have a 16-team playoff, you're deciding the national champion on the basis of 15 games, and you're ignoring the 700 games that are played during the regular season.
Weimerskirch shakes his head at results that discount the regular season, and there are a lot of them. The Green Bay Packers winning last season's Super Bowl as a wild card. The St. Louis Cardinals winning the 2011 World Series also as a wild card. And the University of Connecticut men's basketball team, who finished 9-9 in their conference but won the 2011 NCAA championship. Weimerskirch likens winning six games in March Madness to that coin coming up heads six times in a row. And the proposal for a 16-team football playoff, the one that NCAA President Mark Emmert won't support because it would require too much of the players, that would only require winning four games in a row.
There are lots of teams in the country that can go on a four-game winning streak. Northwestern University went on a four-game winning streak this year, but nobody thinks that they should have been in the national championship game. That when you boil things down to a very short-lived tournament, the outcome is a lot more like flipping coins than deciding it on the football field.
If you need more proof that playoffs don't necessarily result in the better team coming home with the trophy, consider this. Brian McDonald, assistant professor of mathematics at the U.S. Military Academy at West Point, says since 2000, the team with a better regular season record in Major League Baseball and the NFL only won the playoff matchup 50% of the time. For the NHL, the statistic is even lower.
Peter Brand.
Really?
How are you? Hi, how are you doing?
Nice to see you.
Good to have you here.
Billy Beane and Peter Brand reinvented the way the Oakland A's evaluated players, and Brad Pitt turned their story into a blockbuster movie. If an NHL team sees fit to hire Brian McDonald, he won't count wins or even goals. He'll start by counting shots, blocked shots, and missed shots.
And I don't think there's any coaches that go into the locker room at the end of this second period saying, we're playing really well, we're down 1-0. What we really need in this third period is way more missed shots than we've had in the previous two periods.
McDonald says shots, missed, blocked, or successful, are indicators of some very important things in hockey, like possession and territorial advantage. And unlike goals, they're not usually based on luck. Here's another one. Have you heard that this is the era of the quarterback? According to experts, a disproportionate number of the best quarterbacks in history just so happen to be playing right now. Aaron Rodgers set a new record-high quarterback passer rating this season, replacing Peyton Manning in the top spot. Before this season even began, 51 of the top 100 scorers, according to the quarterback passer rating, set their mark since 2000, and 71 since 1990, which didn't seem quite right to Paul Von Dolan of William Patterson University.
I actually feel bad for the guys who played in a much tougher system where the rules did not favor the offense, and they had to take a lot more hits. They weren't as protected by the rules. And so it's important to give them their due as well.
So Professor Von Dolan is suggesting some changes that he hopes will allow for better comparisons between quarterbacks who played under different rules. But like any good mathematician, he doesn't do so without considering the pros and cons.
So what are the advantages of the statistic as it is? Well, it's simple. At least we think it's simple.
Want in on the joke? The simple quarterback passer rating equation reads like this. C divided by A minus 0.3 over 0.2 plus Y divided by A minus 3 over 4 plus T divided by A over 0.05 plus 0.095 minus I divided by A over 0.04. Then all you have to do is multiply the result by 100 over 6. Simple. If all of this math seems to be spoiling the fun of sitting down and watching a game, if, like me, you're not sure you want to be a sports fan in a world where streaks mean nothing, the best team doesn't win the playoffs, and the best quarterback in history might have retired before you were born, Roland Minton of Roanoke College suggests you reconsider.
I use the analogy of looking up at the stars, and some people want to see them twinkling and beautiful, and that's all they want to think about. For me, knowing that behind that is a big gaseous ball and galaxies orbiting each other, that just makes the whole thing truly awesome in the real sense of that word.
Like most of the professors who participated in last week's session on mathematics and sports, Minton uses sports analogies to get his students excited about math. It works, he says, and he has one more sports assumption to debunk before he's through.
I haven't exactly counted numbers, but my experience has been it's really equally interesting and exciting for each of the genders. There are some people that don't like sports. Some of them are guys, some of them are women, and I haven't seen any difference.
So once again, we expect a statistical
difference,
and there just isn't one.
That's right. Spoiling everybody's fun again.
It might have taken a full day of dizzying math lectures, but finally, a statistical conclusion that I do not find to be dismaying, worrying, or even all that surprising. I guess math isn't so bad after all.
Do you know how to add, how to multiply and divide? You're as smart as a tack. Do you know how the rules apply?
Only a Game is produced by Doug Tribou. Our technical director is John Ferrati. Our intern is Jeremy Conlin. We had help this week from Tom Barkley at Georgia Public Broadcasting. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To view photos from Rumford, Maine, or to learn more about this week's music, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from mathematician Mike Weimerskirch, who offers a reason why BCS voters so often mess up the rankings.
They might like the shiny helmets.
Very unscientific, Mike, but you're probably right. I'm Karen Given. Thanks for listening. Bill Littlefield returns next week.
The rules start to change when we start to multiply. T turns to X, but we still keep the equal sign. Remember that zero times anything, anything.
Support comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives, at gatesfoundation.org. And the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for improving education and enrichment for children both in and out of school, at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.